It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Still to come, our guest says it's time to radically rethink the purpose and function of the media to help create more of a vibrant democracy in the 21st century.
First, Congress has a new look starting today. In the midterm elections, Republicans strengthen their control of the House of Representatives and gain control of the U.S. Senate.
Here to talk about what priorities the GOP will set now that they're in control of Congress is John Samples. He's the vice president and publisher at the Cato Institute. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
Well, the Republicans are sweeping in today with big majorities. Now, the last Congress had pretty rotten approval ratings. How important is it, for this group of people to distinguish themselves from the previous Congress?
Well, there was an interview today with the Senate Majority Leader incoming, Mitch McConnell, and he seemed to be looking toward more of a practical outlook and one thing or another and small bore concerns. He's already met with the President Obama to see if they have any common ground about a few issues. I'm not so sure that he's worried a whole lot about the ratings and public opinion polls of Congress, but he clearly is going to try to go in a slightly different direction with the Senate.
Well, what direction do you think that will take? What will that shape look like?
Well, I mean, he said that the one-on-one conversation with President Obama was on three issues, trade, infrastructure spending, and also, another issue, which I can't remember at the moment, tax reform, mm-hmm. which has been something of a concern for Republicans. Now, the idea was that on these three issues, these two people who had parties that don't agree about much might find some common ground. And of those, I would think maybe the most likely is international trade policy. It does seem to be an issue that tax reform is very hard. Infrastructure spending is a possibility, although it has tax issues that are always difficult for Congress.
I understand there is support for the president to be given fast-track authority over trade agreements. How contentious is that?
Well, there would be some issues probably with both parties. The sort of consensus on trade that lasted in the United States for a long time, well into the 90s, when it began to come apart, that is the consensus that more opening up, more liberalized international trade was a good idea, it's been difficult. And frankly, here, you know, we would have to identify the issues. The Republicans, probably in most cases on Mitch McConnell's side, you would get support for that. I think it would require President Obama to either make some deals or to essentially turn away to some degree from part of his congressional support on part of the Democratic Party on Capitol Hill. And it's hard to say in advance how likely that is. You know, it's he's in his last couple of years, but he wants to have a legacy, and he certainly, despite his problems with Congress over the years and his party in Congress, he probably feels some support for them and would probably not go too far down that trail.
One issue that is viewed as sort of a low-hanging fruit for the Republican Congress is a Keystone XL pipeline. Now, the House has already given that the go-ahead. It didn't make it through the Senate, but do you think this is something that will go through quickly now?
Well, you know, there's a big issue that actually is part of our institutional setting here and constitutional setting of this kind of government that is a government divided between Congress and the president, between the two parties, which is that the president has a great deal to say about this because the president has a veto and that you have to have 67 votes in the Senate to override it. Mitch McConnell's 13 votes short of that. It's going to be very hard to do anything that gets much away from President Obama's concerns about issues because he can always use the veto pen. And I think in this case, it's possible that you can certainly get beyond the filibuster, which is around 60 votes. You can get the Keystone debated. You could get a majority for it. Whether you can override a veto or not is another question. And what you would have to do, I think, from the Republican side to be able to override a veto, I think, is a big issue. That is, you might have to give some kind of compromise on a number of issues, maybe policies that the EPA might want to implement. And that, I think, could cause real problems for Mitch McConnell trying to making those kinds of concessions for a Keystone pipeline that itself has taken on, in large measure, a symbolic content more than anything else.
Moving on to the budget now. In the previous Congress, Republicans criticized Democrats for not passing a budget blueprint. How do you expect that to be taken up and handled right now?
I think that will I think McConnell is somewhat aware of having been in that and having been in the past, that they will try to do that and that they probably will use that, particularly the reconciliation part of it or the budget resolution. They can pass it with a simple majority, and they'll probably do something about repealing Obamacare, which will, again, be subject ultimately to the president's veto pen, so it won't actually be done. But it'll be, like many of these things over the next 2 years, it'll be done with an eye toward 2016, the presidential election, the composition of Congress beyond 2016. So if you can get the president and the Democratic Party on the record as having to veto a congressional action to repeal parts or all of Obamacare, Mitch McConnell might see that as a good thing for the 2016 election.
What about Medicare? Do you see that coming up as part of this budget negotiation?
No, I wouldn't think that Medicare would be at issue here. In a sense, there's going to be spending issues, that kind of thing. I think at this point, the parts of Medicare that exist, the Republican Party's not going to be willing to revisit them.
Now, immigration is obviously a really big issue right now for Republicans and for Democrats. Mm-hmm. How do you think Republicans will tackle that hot button issue, knowing that Hispanic voters are watching very closely?
Well, I mean, I think there was some Pew polling that suggested probably a month or two ago that for about half of Hispanic voters, the immigration issues and regulation was not a deal breaker in voting for the Republican Party or not, but it's certainly important to many. In other words, Hispanic voters have many of the similar concerns of other voters. I think the Republican Party will probably, and McConnell will keep that. I mean, one of the things about controlling both houses of Congress is you can keep things off the agenda, particularly in the House, where you have a lot more, the House leaders have a lot more control over what appears and what has to be voted on. So I suspect this has not been something that the leadership's been talking about. It's something that probably part of their constituency cares a lot about, though not all of them. Part of the constituency is for liberalized immigration, the business community it's usually called. Part are not. So I suspect they'll stay away from it. It's not something that could help in the 2016 election necessarily, unless they get a deal that they feel they can defend in 2016.
Now, you mentioned that repealing the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, rolling it back. In other ways, do you expect Republicans to try to chip away at President Obama's legacy now that they do have complete control of Congress?
Yeah, I would think that they would try to raise those questions and try to vote on it. The other part of it that is unambiguous, I suppose, in a sense, for the president as part of his legacy is the Dodd-Frank Act, which his election began in the long ago fall of 2008 during a financial crisis. So making the connection to that and legislation that passed supposedly to deal with that is a big deal. I think there's two sides about that. You might see I don't think you will see it overturned. What you might see on the one hand is some attempts to deal with the Consumer Protection Board that goes with Dodd-Frank to make it more of a responsive to Congress, to make it more responsive to appropriations. The other part of it is, and this is something that will just come up as we go through time, is that a lot of Dodd-Frank was more an effort to delegate power and to allow agencies to do things rather than and so that means congressional oversight will come in on this issue down the line. So you'll see these kinds of boring in a way and maybe not at the center of media coverage, but these kind of oversight issues, I think, will be important for Dodd-Frank. And you'll also see that in the EPA and in environmental policy, where the House has already set up a subcommittee to watch over the EPA. So a lot of this stuff will be these kinds of internecine DC fights, but they might have some potential importance in changing policy.
And just briefly, as we wrap up, the 2016 elections are already looming. How do you think that will affect what happens in Congress?
Well, I think it'll affect everything that happens in Congress, in the sense that Senator McConnell said today that his major concern is getting a Republican president elected in 2016, keeping majorities in both the Senate and the House, and then turning toward what will be actual policy change in, presumably, 2017. It seems like a long and drawn-out process and a very difficult one, but it is the constitutional process for how you change policies, and that's what he's thinking within that context.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Veronica.
We've been speaking with John Samples, Vice President and Publisher at the Cato Institute. Our next guest says the increasing wealth gap in the country is creating a sense of defeat among many Americans, but he says it's time for the nation to blow the roof off the 21st century and see the country through to a post-capitalist democracy.
Robert McChesney is with us in the studio. He's a professor of communication at the University of Illinois. His new book is called Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century: Media, Politics, and the Struggle for Post-Capitalist Democracy. Bob, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, it's my pleasure to be here.
Well, before we dig into the details, big picture, what do you mean, blow the roof off the 21st century?
Well, I argue that I believe that in the 21st century, we're going to go through unbelievable radical change in the world and in the United States. Whether we want to or not, it's not really an option. It's coming. And the question is whether it's going to be radical change we want or radical change we're not going to want. And the roof's getting blown off. And it's getting blown off because we have a series of fundamental crises, economic, environmental, that left to the current pattern are not going to be resolved at all satisfactorily, and they're not sustainable for very long. And so my book is an effort to understand what the problems are and to try to get a new way of thinking to deal with the great problems in front of us and the great possibilities in front of us so that we have a happy ending.
So the core of a lot of the problems, as you describe them, as I read you, is you see a fundamental conflict between democracy, representative government on the one hand, and a capitalist economy on the other. How so?
Well, it's always been a tension. It's always been a tension between the notion of political equality and economic inequality, which is what capitalism is. I mean, it's a few people who have a lot of wealth and a lot of people who don't have any. And the system has worked best when there's been less inequality, when there's been popular participation in politics. It's been its healthiest. The problems mount when you have increasing inequality, like we've had in the last 30 or 40 years, which make functional democracy almost impossible. And I think that's clearly the point we're already at in the United States. The recent studies that I cite in the book by our leading political scientists at our major universities pretty much all come to the same conclusion. If you actually study how decisions are made by the United States government and by state governments affecting foreign policy, economics, regulation, they're made by and for the very wealthiest Americans, and popular participation is virtually nil.
Well, before we get into how we get there, what would there look like? What would the good outcome of the roof being blown off the 21st century, what would it look like in terms of our government and our economic system?
Well, it would mean that the politics would be in command. We'd have democracy first and foremost. What we would do is we'd view our economy as being there to serve people, not people there to serve the economy. So we'd look at issues and say, you know, everyone should have a decent job. Everyone should have a good income. These are things that are foundational to having a good society. If our economy, as it's currently structured, can't produce that, what can we do to get us there? We'd think in terms of enhancing democracy as the guiding value rather than enhancing the privileges of those at the top of the economic system.
Well, people might respond and say, we've got a lot of examples, a lot of case studies of governments trying to manage the economy and not going very well, command economies, creating inefficiencies, that kind of thing.
Well, I couldn't agree more, but I mean, let's be clear. The government's managing this economy, too. It's just managing it on behalf of the people who are benefiting at the top. The government plays an enormous role in our economy. This is not a free market economy. The government plays an enormous role in shaping it, guiding it, subsidizing and bankrolling large firms where necessary. I think the government's going to continue to play a large role, but it ought to be playing a role that responds to the interests and needs of the people of the country democratically. It's not doing that currently. Now, what sort of you know, in the book, I go away from the idea that we should have some picture-perfect model completely different than the status quo that we ascribe to. I'm a gradualist, actually. I think we're going to have rapid change, but I don't think we're going to have a complete flip-flop. But I think you start at areas in our economy and our society that are really troubling. For example, the United States, we spend roughly $1 trillion a year on militarism and national security, more than the rest of the world combined. And, you know, we really don't need to. There's really no military security defensive. We have this enormous, elaborate industry that makes it so they're politically unstoppable in Washington from both sides of the aisle. But it's really not a very rational use of our resources. I would think in a democratic society, we would want to, you know, take the profit out of militarism. Right now, we have a number of industries that make a fortune by ramping up military spending constantly. If we took the profit out of it, like it was for the first 175 years of American history, I suspect there'd be a lot less pressure to endlessly increase it for no reason. And that would make us a much better society.
I want to get into another industry you've written a lot about in the past and in this new book, the media. You say that the media we have allows a very narrow range of political debate to be in the foreground. How did that happen, first of all?
Well, we only have a few
huge
minutes,
story, so, yeah.
to condense a lot. I would say that the problem with there's two great problems with American news media today. One, it barely exists anymore. We just have far fewer working reporters, far fewer resources going to journalism on a per capita basis than we've had probably in American history, certainly in the last 100 years. And it's a sharp fall from just 25 or 30 years ago. So we don't have much journalism. Then what little journalism we have that's left, that's very much overmatched, tends on political issues to let the people in power, Republican and Democrat, sort of say this is the range of legitimate debate. And the great problem we have with what little journalism we have is that it's basically reporters, stenography to people in power. Now, people in power are debating an issue like abortion rights, it gets decent coverage. If people in power are generally in agreement on an issue like the U.S. right to invade any country it wants to at any time, that's never debated. And we never debate whether we have a right to overthrow a government. This is whether we should overthrow it. You know, our right to do it is taken for granted because people in power think that's an innate right that only America has.
You lay out a debate between a media as a market, an industry on the one hand, and media, as you would like to see it, as a public good. What would media as a public good look like?
Well, it's I wouldn't quite frame it that way. I do call for it as public good. I say that journalism is a public good. And what I mean by that is that journalism is something society desperately needs, but the market won't produce in sufficient quality or quantity. And this is actually the framing, a founding principle of this country. Journalism is a commercially viable undertaking on its own, really only emerged in the late 19th century when advertising came along to provide the vast majority of revenues for journalism. Prior to that, in the first 75 years of American history, the framers of this country, the people who wrote the Constitution, understood that the market was insufficient to produce journalism. So we had massive postal subsidies to distribute newspapers almost for free, which made it possible to have this really wide-ranging journalism. I argue that we're at the moment now where it's no longer commercially possible to make money doing journalism. That's why firms have stopped investing in it. That's why newsrooms look like the Berlin countryside in 1945. If we're going to have journalism again, and we have to have it, it's going to require public subsidy, but at the same time, policy in such a way doesn't allow the government to control the content. And I think that's the crucial policy issue we face.
In the internet era, the story goes, anyone can be a journalist. It's free to start up a blog, express your opinions, report on what's in your backyard or in the nation's capital.
Yeah, we do get on an airplane. If anyone could be an airplane pilot, we do send your kids to school, or anyone could be a teacher. You know, it takes resources to do good journalism. It takes competing people. It takes people who are accountable for beats. If we just have a volunteer journalism of people in their free time, we'll have a lot of people writing about the Badger basketball team. Probably not a lot of people going down to sit through county board meetings when toxic rule dumps are being ruled on and complex policies are being debated. That's when you need real journalists. And so, no, it takes resources to have great journalism. That's what's missing. That's what we have to answer.
You'd also like to see a change in the way federal regulations work when it concerns the media, whether we're talking about the internet, broadcast, you name it.
I do. In fact, at the end of the book, I have sort of three core policies I think we ought to be debating right now over the future of communication. One is policies to get journalism back. Another one that's crucial is I think we've got to look long and hard at what I call the ISP cartel, Verizon, Comcast, AT&T, that dominates cell phone and broadband access in the United States. This is a cartel. They literally divided up the market between themselves. These are not free market companies. They were created by government monopoly licenses. They own the politicians today. And as a result of their dominance over policymaking and politicians, Americans pay more for cell phones, pay more for broadband, and we get much worse service than most other nations in the world. They're really parasites. They serve no function. We've got to start talking about why do we even allow them to fleece us every month for the amount of money they do. Most Americans don't understand until they go to another country what a total ripoff we have. This is the sort of issue we ought to be talking about in our politics, but because these companies are so powerful and our system is so corrupt, it's not talked about in our society at all, except on the show.
We're talking with Bob McChesney. He's the author of the new book, Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, about the struggle to achieve what he's looking for, a post-capitalist democracy.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you think today's media landscape serves the needs of the public? What about a democratic society? And what do you think needs to change? You can call us now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Bob McChesney. He's the author of Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, Media, Politics, and the Struggle for Post-Capitalist Democracy.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with him that money, powerful corporations play too big a role in American politics, that the media landscape allows only a narrow range of debate on maybe either end of the spectrum? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And do you think anything's going to change anytime soon? You can also post over at the Central Time Facebook page or email talk@wpr.org. Bob, you spend some time in the new book looking at the protests, the Act 10 labor changes here in Wisconsin state government, and connecting them to the Occupy movement around the country. You see that as a sign that there's maybe a move to change the course of the future from the ground up.
Well, I think what was striking about Madison, and I live in Madison when I'm not teaching in Illinois, so I was not teaching that semester in 2010, four years ago, when the occupation of the Capitol and the demonstration took place. So I was able to go down there most every day and experience it. And I was in the crowd. I wasn't up in the bandstand or being a leader or anything. I was just one of the people there. And it was an extraordinary experience, I think, for everyone who was there. And it reminded me how important freedom to assemble is one of our core freedoms in the First Amendment, how it's always been understood that probably the most important right people have is to come together and peacefully get together and redress their grievances to the government. And it was an extraordinary experience because it put a lie to the very notion that most Americans were happy going along with cutbacks and this and that and sort of business as usual, that the society wasn't running right. And, it didn't win out as the protesters would have liked, but it really was a hopeless task in the short term. I mean, they didn't have the numbers, so it was really a protest, classic protest in that sense. But I don't think it was something that just people gave up and said, okay, we give up now, that was hopeless, we were wrong, the other side was right. I think it was a sign of what much more is to come. That will look like the Ozarks and the Rockies are ahead of us.
But was that a protest looking for fundamental changes, or was it like it looked to some people outside, a group, a particular class, government employees trying to protect their interests?
Well, I don't think anyone who said that actually attended the protest like I did. I think that's one of the things that most of the people who made that sort of criticism were making it from New York City at the Fox TV studios or somewhere else outside of Wisconsin. If you were there, you saw an extraordinarily heterogeneous group of people cutting across demographic lines from all walks of life, who are just concerned about the fact that the society is becoming increasingly polarized and governance is becoming increasingly corrupt, and really wanted fundamental change about it. And what was striking about being there almost every day for 6 or 8 weeks was talking to a lot of people, seeing the unbelievable signs that were made, was just, how thoughtful people were. And they actually had a chance to think about politics and social questions. They had a lot to say. They had a lot in their mind. People are normally told just to shut up and shop. And it was an exciting, exhilarating experience. And I think it tells us there's a lot more of that on the horizon.
Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. We have Scott on the line in Iron River. Scott, hi.
Hi there. Good afternoon. Say, whenever I have a chance to argue politics, and I tend to be moderate, middle of the road, but argue politics with somebody who is of, you know, of the Republican, the right wing side, they always seem to pull out of their back pocket the left wing media, and that the mainstream media is controlled by the left. And I'm never quite sure how to respond to that, where that's coming from and how to respond. And thanks much. I'll take my answer off the air.
Scott, thanks for the call. Bob, I think you've thought about this issue a time or two in the past.
Well, this is something that came up in the United States probably in the 1950s, 60s, or 70s. And it occurred during a brief period when professional journalism had a certain amount of autonomy from the owners. Because traditionally, there was the idea of left-wing media was nonsense. It was owners controlled the media, and they were generally conservative, so the media represented their viewpoints. And there was a brief period in which professional journalists tended to be more liberal than, say, the owners were at their news media. And that's when conservatives got very upset that the traditional ownership of the media didn't mean you got to dominate what the politics of the media were. And so it became a big campaign starting in the late 60s through the 70s and 80s. I think the evidence shows that it was always exaggerated, and it's especially been exaggerated recently when there's not much media left. And I think it would be difficult for someone to look at the samplings of news media today and say we have a left-wing media in the United States, unless they have a definition of left-wing that simply is bizarro.
Go back to our callers now. Adriana in Bayfield. Adriana, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, I'm wondering what the caller thinks as far as people being able to change the political system from the ground up. I registered as a libertarian. I voted for a libertarian candidate in the last election. And I noticed one of the problems that that candidate was running into is that they can't ever get into debates. Like, states kind of limit who can get into debates, so it's just Republicans and Democrats. And I'm wondering, if people started doing their own research, would they be able to, like, kind of give momentum to these alternative candidates and maybe change the political system that way?
Boy, that's a great question. That's a really important issue. We have a two-party duopoly control over politics in this country. You know, it's ironic for a country that prides itself on its own loving competition. As George Carlin, the great comedian, put it, America, a love competition, you get it in most places, but you don't get it in the two places that count, telephone companies and political parties. There we have no competition. We have a duopoly. And it's dreadful for democracy. It's really indefensible. We see the results we get. We definitely need to blast open the system. I wish I could tell you there was an easy way to do it, to either get more parties or more competition so new voices get in. But it also means you'd have to get rid of the power of money in politics. They really go hand in hand. They're closely related. So I applaud you. I keep trying to try to blast the system open, and I wish I could give you a happier short-term answer. But I can give you a happy long-term answer, which is that as soon as there's a crack in the edifice, there are a lot of people out there eager for different voices. The vast majority of Americans who currently don't vote, and I think a lot of them would like to participate if there was a rational reason to do so.
So what are you hoping to see to make these changes you're looking for, Bob? I mean, a rebirth of the Occupy movement, bigger and stronger, or a new interest in electoral politics, a third party, a change in one of the two parties? Where does change come from?
It's impossible to predict exactly. One of the things I talk about in the introduction of the book that I think is really important, oftentimes we get hamstrung trying to make a correct prediction of the future. And because we can't anticipate how it's going to look, we figure nothing's going to ever happen. It's one of the faults of being of humans. It's a rational response. We look at the future based on what we see in the present. We base the present on what we saw in the last 48 hours. So we can never predict the future accurately. No one predicted the Wisconsin uprising before it happened. No one predicted the civil rights movement before it happened. Nothing's ever predicted before it happened. People, after it happens, everyone said, yeah, I saw it coming. Baloney. No one saw it coming. They could have understood it would eventually happen, but no one saw it coming when it did. So it's impossible to say how it's going to happen. The one thing we do know is that the pressures that are taking place in society are not sustainable. Growing inequality, the corruption we have, we can look at historical patterns. Something's got to give. When you add in the environmental crises and the growing joblessness, I think it's a pressure cooker. What we can do as citizens in the society is try to understand these pressures, try to learn about them, try to find solutions that will be humane and democratic and just. Because if we don't have democratic involvement in answering these problems, if they're made by elites behind closed doors, the only thing we can be certain of, they won't be made in our interest.
So, I mean, on a practical level, you're calling on people to learn, come up with solutions. But what stuff do you think people would be best occupied doing to change things?
It depends on where they are in their life and what they're doing with their life. I'm a college professor. I write books and do radio shows and talk to people. I go to public groups. I think some people get involved with their church groups, or their unions, or civic organizations to raise issues and get people involved. Some people get involved in politics, and I admire all my friends I've known who've run for office. I think it is an incredibly difficult thing to do, who've worked on campaigns. Sometimes it's working on demonstrations. You know, there's a whole range of things to do, a lot of issues to get involved in. And one of the things that we've learned in my research, and I learned from going around the country, by not having a news media anymore that covers politics, and we really don't have one that does, there's very few reporters that cover it, what a lot of Americans listening to the show wouldn't realize is there are thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Americans who are actually very interested in politics. They're working on issues all the time to get money out of politics, to get rid of the corruption there. We've already got 15 or 16 states that passed resolutions calling for a constitutional amendment to take money out of politics. Most Americans don't realize that. It's further along than constitutional amendments for women's rights or a lot of the other ones were at a similar point in time. But since it's not covered, people assume no one's doing anything. There's a lot going on, and, you know, the ultimate point here is that, you know, when you look in the mirror, either you're going to do something or not. You're going to be positive or you're going to be negative. If you act like social change for the better is impossible, you guarantee it'll be impossible. Your choice is whether you're going to act like there's a hope or there isn't. And, you know, that's the one choice each of us has to make.
Bob, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Bob McChesney, author of the book Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, about the struggle to achieve what he's looking for, a post-capitalist democracy. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Wisconsin's calendar is filled year-round with Lutheran lutefisk dinners, Catholic fish fries, and other church-sponsored meals. These events serve as fundraisers and as carriers of community identity and tradition. John Hildebrand explains why we like paying money to stand in line at these meals.
On a cold night in January, the head cook ducks out of the kitchen to assess the crowd lined up in the school cafeteria. If the line ends at the double doors, all is well. But if it snakes out the doors and past the low-set water fountain to the coat racks in the hallway, he'll need to add another 60 pounds of Alaskan pollock to the pot. "Father," says the cook, jogging back to the kitchen, "I don't mean to rush you, but we could really use some more fish." Reverend Eugene Klink bends over the cafeteria sink in the same posture I've seen him bent over the altar during the offertory, and for somewhat the same purpose: to feed the multitude. He thaws the frozen fish into limp fillets that go into a boiling cauldron, along with a basket of peeled onions and another of red potatoes. 3 minutes later, when the cook and his assistants hoist the steaming baskets from the cauldron, a heat wave runs through the room as if the kitchen had suddenly crash-landed in some equatorial jungle, where the ambient temperature was 100 degrees, and the air smelled heavy with garlic, onions, and oregano. For 20 years, Immaculate Conception Parish has held a New England-style fish boil every other Friday night between the end of January and Easter, a six-week period which roughly coincides with Lent, that gray season of self-denial and giving up. But it's hard to see what patrons of the fish boil give up except cooking for the night. What they get, besides fish, potatoes, carrots, coleslaw, and a little ice cream cup, is a break from winter doldrums. It's a chance to mingle with strangers and to relive that thrilling moment from childhood when you look up from your lunch tray and wonder where to sit. I'd come the night before the fish boiled, help with preparations: 300 pounds of carrots and potatoes, 200 pounds of onions. The men gravitated towards the onions, cutting them at arm's length, while the women peel the carrots with a motion like dealing cards. As they worked, the women compared notes on the competition, fish suppers offered at neighboring parishes. "Those others," said a carrot peeler, "are deep fried." Most often, I worked the fish boil as a dishwasher, the kitchen equivalent of playing left field, because there's little pressure and plenty of time to look around. The other volunteers are people I see the rest of the year only in their professional guises, and it's reassuring to see them in a different uniform. Priest, salesman, dentist, all of us wearing the same plastic apron with a paper name tag. Only the cook crew are set apart by their pinstripe cloth aprons and no name tag, because everyone knows who they are. As the customers trickle down towards the end of the evening, the cook retrieves a few cans of beer that have been cooling in the walk-in freezer for just this moment. The beer is passed from one volunteer to another to become the unspoken grace after the meal.
John Hildebrand is the author of several books, including his most recent, The Heart of Things, a Midwestern Almanac. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Well, born from those church basements and community gatherings, the Community Cookbook was an early form of social networking.
Before the giant full-color cookbooks we see today, Americans relied on simple, handwritten collections of tried-and-true recipes passed on from generations.
To talk about the history of community cookbooks, we're joined by Tracy Nathans-Kelly, a culinary historian at Cornell University. Tracy, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's going to be great fun to talk to you. Thanks for having me in.
Well, I've seen these community cookbooks. I've had a few. I think anybody's grandparent probably has a collection of them. But how did these community cookbooks first start circulating?
As far as we've been able to tell, those of us who have been kind of hunting backwards on the history of these things, there were a few that came out around the Civil War era. And they were first produced to raise money for bandages and other needs for the wars. And so churches and other community groups would put out these very low-end little recipe collections in order to raise what money they could to support their soldiers.
And what do you think we can learn about a particular community or region by looking at their cookbooks?
It's one of my favorite things to do is to hunt backwards once we see one of these community cookbooks. So I first became interested in them when I lived in northern North Dakota. And I would pick up the local cookbooks there because, well, they were everywhere, right? They were at the thrift stores and they were in the used bookstores and wonderful recipes. And I started to look very closely at the women that were in them and how they portrayed their food. What I noticed is often the desserts, the cakes, the pies, all the yummy things make up the bulk of these recipes. and that makes sense because baking is more of a science than maybe slow cooking or doing a roast, right? You have to have all your measurements correct. But there would be these intriguing moments where we would see almost the same cake recipe over and over and over again inside one of these collected cookbooks, maybe from a church or something. They'd be very similar. So it was obviously a popular cake or dish at that time. Other times when I would see very old ones, perhaps, all of a sudden, if I had several in a row from the same organization, I would see canned salmon start to show up in a lot of these recipes. Well, obviously, canned salmon was now available on the shelf. And so it marked not only food trends, but also quite early availability of certain foodstuffs that may be in or out of vogue or in and out of availability, if you will.
Well, you can kind of do a culinary archaeology there in a way. And do you see maybe a shifting ethnic traditions as well when you look at a region over time?
Absolutely. In fact, some of my favorite cookbooks from North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, Minnesota make very strong efforts in documenting their heritage. I want to say, I'm not at home, so I don't have my bookshelf right in front of me. I want to say that from Wisconsin in particular, there is a cookbook that divides out its recipes not by dinners, side dishes, cakes, and so forth. Rather, the delineations are by ethnic groups. So we'll see Luxembourgers, of all things, right? German, Native American recipes. So they divide out by the ethnic heritage. And so you would go to that section if you wanted some lutefisk. Well, you would know right where to go, to the Norwegian section. And so it was a very concerted effort to bring forth all of these special dishes that needed to be documented, saved, recorded, archived for their communities.
Now, obviously, it's a lot. It's very telling about history to look at these cookbooks, but how do the recipes themselves stack up over the years?
One of my best recipes is from an Immaculate Conception Lutheran cookbook that I have. It's got a nice yellow cover that's got lots of stains on it. It's for cocktail meatballs.
Ah.
These recipes are fantastic. because you would only put your best recipes out there for the public to see.
Now, these are coming at a time, a lot of them, I imagine, before women were voting in this country, before women were represented in media or the publishing industry. Were these a big deal in you know, a voice and a creative outlet, I guess, for women?
I think that they were. I think if you would have asked them at the time if that's what it was, they would have denied it, right? It wasn't seen quite in that light, but it absolutely was. And what's part of that archaeology we were talking about a couple minutes ago is when you open these books, pay attention to how the women are representing themselves. So in early days, we would often see them go by their husband's name. So, you know, Mrs. David Peterson instead of Alice Peterson, or even, you know, going by their maiden name. And every now and again, you will see somebody represented in those books without their marriage title with them, or obviously with still their maiden name, and that would indicate not married or perhaps widowed or something else, right? Sometimes it takes a little bit of investigation. And other books, you'll see quite a mix of how women represent themselves to the outside world. The ones that I love and that are very rare are when women include pictures of themselves. And so one of my favorite cookbooks is out of a small town in North Dakota, and just a little stapled thing put together, probably 40 pages. Every single picture is dedicated to one woman. Her picture is large and beautiful. There's a little short biography of her, sometimes autobiography if she's still alive, and then her one best recipe. And that is an absolute treasure. What's funny in that one, though, is that there are no men pictured. So if it's an anniversary photo, they've lopped the men off of that picture. It was decidedly a book about the women. And sometimes you would see their kids or grandkids, but not the husbands. It wasn't their turn.
That's such a personal approach.
Yes.
Well, you mentioned the cocktail, I think it was meatballs, from that recipe that is one of your favorites now. Do you have other favorite recipes as you go over and you look at some of these community cookbooks?
Well, you know, I take a hankering to them. Well, what's terrible is you start cooking all these things, right? And you kind of have to watch your waistline a little bit. There's another, incidentally, meatball recipe that Joan Peterson, right there in Madison, brought to my attention called porcupine meatballs. I'm sure a lot of our listeners know what that is. And so I've tried lots of different versions of that. That recipe is amazing.
What's a porcupine meatball?
Yeah. It's basically a meatball, a little bit wetter than usual, but you would roll it in instant rice and then cook it with the sauce. And so the rice kind of sticks to the meatball, but it also cooks and plumps up, so it looks like a little porcupine, if you do it right. There's wonderful recipes for very fancy fruit salads, which, of course, in the dead of winter, you know, canned fruit and coconut and whipped cream, these were fantastically beautiful desserts that you would take to these church dinners that we were just hearing about.
Oh, they sound delicious. Tracy, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this with us.
Anytime.
We've been speaking with Tracy Nathans-Kelly. She's a culinary historian at Cornell University.